Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing.
And Bubba Wallace.
You know what's the worst part of a race? A rain delay.
Sitting around, waiting for the track to dry, is dull.
But instead of waiting, we hang out with Chumba Casino.
Social casino slots, bingo, solitaire, plenty of fun to keep us entertained.
So why let a rain delay slow you down? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey guys, Fly on the Wall is back for another season. That's right, on audio and video every Monday and Thursday.
Follow and listen to Fly on the Wall everywhere you get your podcasts.
2-0. And a blast way back left field, and forget about it. My goodness, Nick Castellanos. A long home run to left field down the line. It's a two-run shot, and it is a 3-0 Phillies lead.
And it would only get better from there. Thank you, Scott Fransky. Thank you, L.A., for that at the end, which was good punctuation for last night's game. Good morning, everybody, along with Mike Sielski from The Inquirer. I am Glenn Macnow. Morning, Mike.
Good morning, Glenn.
It was a great night down at the ball yard yesterday. Nick Castellanos hits the home run. Rhys Hoskins hit a home run. Darrick Hall hits a home run. JT Realmuto hits a home run. Who am I leaving out? There were five. Who did I leave out?
You said Darrick Hall, Castellanos, JT, and Hoskins, right?
Hoskins. Yeah. Shame on me.
First run on the board.
Shame on me. Castellanos heating up, Mike. Let me give you this. He is now, in his last 10 games, .368 with an OPS of .905.
Rumor is that the Phillies are going to sign Jim Salisbury to a contract in which he engages in a heated back and forth with Nick Castellanos every morning to keep Castellanos hitting at this level.
Hey, Jim can take all the credit. I would not argue with any of that. Anyway, the Phillies go to a 7-2 win over the really lowly Washington Nationals.
Can we say that the Nationals are, in your favorite term, tanking?
Well, yes, we can say that. And the good news is the Phillies play them a ton of times between now and the end of the year. The Phillies play the Nationals, they play the Marlins, they play the Pirates. The Phillies' schedule looks really easy. And now the Phillies have won 9 of the last 11. They are 10 games above .500 for the first time this season. Interesting, I was looking at the standings. It's a three-way tie now among the Phillies, Milwaukee, and St. Louis. Two of those three teams are going to make the playoffs. One of Milwaukee, St. Louis makes it because they will win the division. You liking the chances?
I do. The Phillies, if I'm not mistaken, hold the tiebreakers over both of those teams. So combine that with the moves that Dave Dombrowski made at the trade deadline. Combine those two factors with the fact that, as you said, JT Realmuto and Nick Castellanos, two guys who you're paying a ton of money to, who had been having below average seasons, are starting to hit. I think you got to feel pretty good about the Phillies' chances here.
Liking it a lot. And by the way, they do have 9 games left against the Nationals, and that's, you know, they've won 16 of the last 18, and that was before Washington dumped everybody. Tonight, Ranger Suarez against that lefty, two lefties tonight, against that Patrick Corbin, who's a decent pitcher, but
he
like it. All right, let's spend a minute talking about what happened this week, because I heard some talk on the station that it wasn't enough. They should have made a big splash. You know, Juan Soto went to San Diego, and what did we get? I'll pitch it to you. I like what they got. Give me your assessment of these deals.
I like what they got, too. I think Brandon Marsh is the kind of risk that you ought to be taking at the trade deadline, right? A controllable player with potential. The Phillies, and I know this is kind of a common response when asked about a player who is perceived to be underachieving as a hitter. Well, we see something there that we can unlock. And that's going to put a lot of pressure on Kevin Long, the Phillies hitting coach, to unlock the potential in Marsh's swing. But what he can do is play center field. He can track a ball down. And as anybody who has spent any time watching Odubel Herrera play center field over the last, 6 or 7 years, you know how valuable a skill that can be. So in the main, I like that deal. Obviously, Noah Syndergaard is not the Noah Syndergaard who was with the Mets, who was, throwing.
Yeah, that was a pretty disturbing debut the other night.
Yeah.
11 hits in 5 innings.
Yeah.
And some of those balls were hit right on the nail.
They were. And that's what you don't want, 11 hits in 5 innings, but 5 innings is what you kind of are hoping for out of Syndergaard. I will say this, we didn't mention this in the open. It was fun to watch Kyle Gibson pitch.
Oh, yeah, shame.
Last night.
Normally, when a guy has a perfect game through 6, we do bring it up, but he did. Looked terrific.
He looked great. His ball had a lot of movement. Just as a kind of personal preference thing, it was so nice to be able to watch a Major League Baseball game where the starting pitcher was relevant for a long time during the game. I think that's the biggest thing that baseball misses nowadays. But be that as it may, if you can get something close to that out of Kyle Gibson for the rest of the season, you'll take that. Is he a guy you're going to count on in a short playoff series? Of course not. Not necessarily. But they got to get there first.
I also really like the moves. I'll give you 2 reasons I really like the moves. One is you got rid of a lot of trash this week.
Yes, you did.
You know what? That's a nasty way for me to say it. You got rid of a lot of flotsam this week.
Is that
better?
You got rid of players who weren't helping you win.
Right. Thank God Odubel is out of here.
Yeah.
He was a really dumb fundamental player for a lot of years. I was sorry to see Didi Gregorius kind of go out this way, but he's a shot player.
Yes, he is.
He goes somewhere and it picks up again, but it wasn't going to be here. Familia was terrible when he was here. It was an awful signing this year. And Moniak, you know, I know he had a home run his first night. Hey, good luck to you. It wasn't going to happen here. That's what they gave up. And they didn't give up any of those prized prospects. So that's one thing that I was really delighted with. And the other one is this. For the last 2, 3, 4 years, the bullpen on this team has just been an anchor. It's been an albatross. It's awful. Bullpen's been doing a lot better this year. Sir Anthony has been pitching really well. Andrew Bellotti, to me, looks like he's a pitcher. He's a name that nobody ever talks about, but I think he's actually a pitcher. And now Alvarado versus lefties has been very good. And now you added, for the second time, hopefully with better results, David Robertson came in, had a save. Mike, could it be, after all this time, that the bullpen is not a weakness but a strength for the Phillies?
I think that's absolutely the case. You know, I think it's interesting. The Robertson move is interesting to me because I think in some people's minds, the default reaction to it is, oh, no, that guy was already here and it didn't go well, and now the Phillies are going back to that. Well,
yeah, been there, done that. Right.
But look at David Robertson's career. He has been an excellent relief pitcher throughout his career. It might have just been bad timing and bad luck that he got hurt during his time with the Phillies. And he spoke openly, I think even before the trade was made, where he said, you know, I wouldn't mind going back to Philadelphia. I feel like I left something there. There's unfinished business there. I feel like I owe them something. And I think you're right, Glenn. We talked about this a little bit last week, the idea of, yeah, you can make a big splash and give up those prospects, or you can get a little more creative and think a little differently about how you try to improve the team. And yeah, you get Syndergaard, but in the absence of adding another real top-flight starter, you bolster a strength. You make a strength stronger. And that's what they did with getting Robertson. As you said, the bullpen's been pretty good. Now it should be even better with Robertson. I really like what they did, and now it's just in the hands of those guys on the roster.
Yeah, I feel very good about it. We have been here in August before. We've been here the last couple of years, and they have been in the race. But I do think it's different this year. First of all, for whatever reason, this manager's got them together. The interim manager, Rob Thompson, he could end up the manager of the year as an interim manager. Has that ever happened before?
I think maybe Jack McKeon did it with the Marlins in 2003.
Okay.
I think.
He was 78 years old at the time.
Something like that.
Yeah. Okay.
He was eating dinner at 4 o'clock, you know, 3 hours before first pitch.
Been there. But anyway, I am feeling very optimistic, very good about this team for everything we just mentioned. I think they're going to go to the playoffs, and once you get to the playoffs, anything can happen.
This is just me. I think the telling moment, the underrated telling moment of this season so far to me, happened a week ago Friday when Odubel Herrera made that base-running blunder against the Pirates on Friday night. Now, it ended up not costing the Phillies anything. They ended up tying the game, going on to win it. But you could see Rob Thomson in that dugout demonstrably frustrated and angry with Odubel Herrera.
Talk to him.
And within a week, Odubel was out of here, finally.
That's a great point.
And that, to me, kind of symbolizes where the Phillies are now and maybe why you ought to believe that this is real, or at least realer than it was in 2018 or 2019.
All right, 215-592-9494. 215-592-9494 if you want to talk to Mike or to me. I like that last point you made. That was really good. Okay, want to throw in something else here. We are 6 days away from the Eagles preseason. You know how it always goes? And we might have talked about this a couple weeks ago. No, probably not. We weren't doing shows a couple weeks ago. I always look so forward to the start of training camp. And then 3 days into training camp, it's like, oh, this is boring. When do we get the preseason? Right? We're not learning anything in training camp. We're not seeing anything. 99.9% of the fans don't get to view it at all. So you wait. And when's the preseason? Okay, there's the preseason. Next Friday, it's going to start. Oh, we're going to get to watch everybody. And then the preseason is going to be all those guys who will not be on the team when the season starts. Right. Some, you know, but it's the preseason, like, ugh, when's the season start? But next Friday night, New York Jets here at the Link, Philadelphia Eagles. I will ask you, and I will ask our listeners, tell me something realistically that you are looking forward to seeing next Friday night.
Okay, so two things that I personally am looking forward to seeing. I don't know how much we're going to see of the first team offense. So I think it's easy to say I want to see Jalen Hurts. I'm not sure how much we're going to learn about Jalen Hurts and the Eagles offense from these three preseason games.
I don't think we're going to see any Jalen Hurts. Do you?
I think we might see a series or two at most.
Okay.
The two guys I want to see for different reasons are, number one is N'Kobe Dean, who has not, he's been fine in training camp, but he is not been one of those guys where you say, oh, we've got to get, the Eagles have to get this guy on the field. He's looked okay, but it's, I want to see what happens when the lights are on and he's actually on the field in game situations, because he was so good at Georgia. I just want to see how what I saw from him in college compares to a facsimile of a Sunday in the NFL. The other thing I want to see, and this is kind of the way I'm wired, the other guy I want to see is Jalen Reagor.
Oh, you stole my guy.
Did I really?
Yeah. He stole one of my two. But
yeah,
go ahead. You go.
Just because there is so much swirling around him.
Yep.
Former first round pick, going against the backups throughout camp, has made some plays, has gotten into it with people on Twitter, all of that. I want to see what he does. Is he really any better, or is this all just sound and fury?
As my grandfather used to say, I don't know if people still use this cliche, but my grandfather used to say, Lenny, it's time to fish or cut bait. And I say, Grandpa, you don't fish. He says, yeah, well, you know what I mean. And it is for him. It is. Yeah. And there are guys who are pressing him. Look, he's behind A.J. Brown. He's behind Devonta Smith. He's behind Quez Watkins. He's behind Zach Pascal, right?
Yeah.
Who's done throwing up now?
I sure hope so.
Man, that guy had food poisoning. He, like, threw up for 4 days or something? Okay. Nonetheless.
Can we move on from that topic?
Yeah, let's do it. So it's what? Him versus John Hightower versus Greg Ward versus whoever, you know, shows up that we don't know about. He's 50-50 to make the team, and he is a former first-round draft pick, and he has a ton to prove. So I agree with you. That's a great one, and he will get a lot of playing time.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. And okay. I would be hesitant to keep him only because I have an irrational appreciation for Greg Ward.
You too?
Not that he should be a number one, two, or three wide receiver, just that I love his story, and I think the guy knows how to get open, and that's the kind of guy who should have a job.
And he's a good teammate.
Yes.
Yeah, Merrill loves him. Loves him. Loves him. I would have no problem with Reagor being out of here unless he plays really well, because I don't think his attitude is helping the team.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
And I don't think it ever has. And if you're the fourth, fifth wide receiver, and plus, I don't know how much he's going to play special teams. I need that guy to play special teams. I don't know if he can do that. The other guy that I really want to see, you take N'Kobe Dean, which is great. I'm going to take the first round pick. I so much want to see the big boy out
Jordan
there. Yeah,
Davis.
Jordan Davis running out there in the middle of the defense, clogging it up, stopping guys, not being moved. You know, it's one of those things where, like, I don't care if he makes tackles. I just want it to be that he's there. They got to change direction. Somebody else makes the tackle. I'm really excited about Jordan Davis. when the draft was occurring, we were broadcasting the draft, right? It was me and Ike and Elliot and so on, and we're all looking like, okay, who's falling? Who's getting picked? What does this mean? And I'm thinking, Jordan Davis, man. I just want Jordan. And he stayed. They stayed there, and they got him.
He's almost like it's – how can I put this? I'm very intrigued by the possibility of having Jordan Davis be a force on the defensive line and Jordan Mailata continue to be a force on the offensive line, because they are the two biggest human beings I have ever encountered in my life.
Huge.
And it is remarkable to stand near them and understand what incredible athletes they are.
I met Jordan Davis at the Maxwell Clubs last year, right? Right, the Maxwell Club, the one over in Jersey.
Yes.
Yeah, it was Maxwell Club. That was it. Where Ray got honored, right?
Who?
Yes.
I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I hope so. And Jordan Davis was the college defensive player of the year. So, you know, I got to meet him when I was with Ray, and I shook his hand, and I'm telling you, it was like shaking hands with a baseball glove.
Yeah.
His hands were huge. Everything was huge. Love him.
I do, too. I'm really
like
curious.
Such a good kid.
Yeah, I'm curious to see him, too. He seems a very outgoing guy, kind of guy who, if he lives up to expectations as a first-round pick and becomes a solid to terrific player, becomes, you think, like the next iteration of a Brandon Graham kind of a guy, because he has that kind of personality.
All right, so we ask you this question. You know what you're going to, you know what you're probably not going to see during preseason. The Eagles are not going to play a lot of their first unit guys. Jalen Hurts, did he play at all in the preseason last year?
I think he played a series or
okay,
two.
Okay, well, then that's it. So realistically, we ask you, what do you want to see in the preseason? You know what the expectations are. You've been waiting for this. Who and what are you looking to see? 215-592-9494. Pete in Springfield starts us off. Hi there, Pete.
Good morning, guys. How you feel?
Doing great.
Well, first of all, it's been a long time. I used to work at the Montgomery County Record. Way back in the day, and I had actually met and worked with Mike Groves back when.
Pete, it's great to hear from you.
Yes, it's been a long time, back days of Nick Fierro and Ira Joseph and all them, and Wayne and so forth. So
great guys.
Great guys, right. Well, I'm calm. I'm not here to defend Odubel, okay? But I am going to tell you that they still have a little bit of a weak link. Now, I love him as his attitude, and he's obviously leads the team in home runs. But if you take the home runs away from Kyle Schwarber, he's the biggest bust that you've ever had. Okay.
Take the home runs away from the league leading with 32 now?
Yes.
34.
34, excuse me, on pace for
45?
At least.
Yeah,
so,
that means a lot.
You understand that on its face, and you seem like a nice guy, and Mike's not going to want to insult you, so I will. On its face, it's a ridiculous statement to say, if you take away all those home runs, that's like saying, if you take away the 50 touchdown passes that Dan Marino had that year, he did nothing.
Yeah, but guess what? When you have more home runs than you actually have hits, okay, and you're on pace to come to major league leader ever in strikeouts, okay, and you're leading off and you're hitting .203, okay, now, and also in the outfield, he's probably worse than Odubel, okay?
He's not playing center field.
The alligator arms, everything that comes to him.
This is the anti-Schwarber agenda here is very surprising.
If a ball comes, the ball is coming tracking toward him, and he knows he can't get it, he just waves his arm at it.
Yeah.
Alligator arm.
Okay. By the way, he's on pace for 51 home runs.
There you go. I undersold him.
Which isn't so bad. He's on pace for 100 runs scored, 100 RBIs.
And he's had like 6 walks in the last 3 weeks.
He has 57 walks in 104 games. That puts him on pace for about 80. Not bad. Leads the team in walks.
All right.
Hey, listen, we got your point of view. I think it's ridiculous, but I will admit 204 is not what I'm looking to see out of him, and he's a defensive sieve, but we knew the defensive part.
Yeah, and if every hit he gets travels 425 feet, I think you'll take that. You know, look, I think it's, to your point, Glenn, it's kind of like complaining that if you take away the Academy Award-winning performances of Robert De Niro, he isn't much of an actor.
Yeah, well, I did see Dick Tracy, and that would support that
Pacino,
point.
That's not Robert De Niro.
Oh, he wasn't in that. That's right. Okay, well, he made a lot of bad movies, too. But
he did.
Good point by you. Okay, so the point I thought he was going to make was he's not a good leadoff hitter. I don't know why he chose to defend Odubel as part of it, because he and Odubel didn't play the same position. It's a whole different thing. They don't have a leadoff hitter, which is problematic. Is there looking at the guys they have, is there somebody you would put in the leadoff spot?
No. We batted this around last week.
I know.
There really isn't anyone else who fits the bill. Now, I suppose if they are able to fix Brandon Marsh's swing, quote-unquote fix his swing, he would be the kind of guy maybe that you could put up there, but he strikes out a lot. And you've got a ways to go before you can even think about putting him at the top of the lineup. So in the absence of anyone else, Kyle Schwarber is leading the National League in home runs as a leadoff hitter. Leave him there as a leadoff hitter.
Yeah, you get more at bats that way anyway. Okay,
yeah.
I agree. All right, so I would say that maybe he was not in Dick Tracy, but he was in Dirty Grandpa, and
that's terrible.
That was De Niro's worst performance.
That's pretty bad.
Struggling to come up with something, but that was the one.
That's a good question. Like, what was the last great movie Robert De Niro was in? Was it The Irishman?
Yeah, which wasn't great, but it was good. It was pretty solid.
It was a lot long.
Of people, yeah, it was that. I think it's still going. 215-592-9494. 215-592-9494. Batting around the Phillies. Whatever your thoughts are on that. And also the preseason. What do you want to see? Eagles play next Friday. It's 6 days away. You've been waiting for it. There's going to be 65,000 people there. What are you hoping to see? With Mike Seale.
Ready to level up? Chumba Casino is your playbook to fun. It's free to play with no purchase necessary. Enjoy hundreds of online social games like blackjack, slots, and solitaire anytime, anywhere with fresh releases every week. Whether you're at home or on the go, let Chumba Casino bring the excitement to you. Plus, get free daily login bonuses and a free welcome bonus. Join now for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Play Chumba Casino today. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. TNCs apply.
Listeners, I want to tell you about a new podcast from Odyssey called Family Lore, where people tell interesting stories about their family history, and then we investigate the truth behind them. Family Lore is available now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your shows.
I'm Glenn Mack now. Along with Mike Sielski, I'm Glenn Mack now. By the way, coming up today at 11, it's going to be a real treat. Dan Baker is going to join us. The Phillies honored Dan last night for 50 years as the PA announcer. And Mike, you know him. I know him. He's a character, and he's a great guy.
I have a terrific story about Dan back from when I was a kid.
Oh, nice.
That I'll bring up with him, and that hopefully I think gets to the heart of who he is.
Nice. Well, we're gonna have him coming up. We have a What We're Watching with, by the way, a new sounder. Very excited about.
Oh yeah,
very excited about that. We'll talk about Dick Vermeil getting into the Hall of Fame today. We will soon get into the Eagles run versus pass situation, but let's get Mike from Yardley up here first. Good morning, Mike.
Hey, good morning, Mike and Glenn. I've never talked to Mike before, but. And I've been gone for a month out west, so I've missed a lot of what's happened in the last month. But I'm going to start off with the Phillies. It's so great to have a team that you can follow, that you can see as being legitimately competitive. I don't know where the Schwarber hate came from. He's the first batter. He's going to get more at-bats than anybody. And if the only thing he does is hit home runs, that's like... Buddy yeah. Ryan talking about
Chris Carter.
Yes, exactly. All he does is catch touchdowns. Thank you. I'll take it. The other thing is that, you know, as good as Gibson was last night, you got to figure we've got three outstanding starters and a bunch of guys who might be competing for that third spot as well. You know, they're set up to have a really good playoff run if only. Bryce Harper can come back and be
The third great starter? Who's your given as a great starter?
Well, I'm not given as a great starter, but I have missed Ranger Suarez for a month. But when I look at the stats, he looks like he's been unhittable for his last three or four games.
You know, he's obviously not as good this season as he was last season, and it was it would be unreasonable to have expected him to be that good.
Yep.
I mean, his ERA was under two. It was insane.
Yeah.
But, you know, Glenn and I were talking about this last week. We love a crafty lefty because there are so few of them left in Major League Baseball anymore. And I believe Suarez gives opposing hitters a look that anymore they don't encounter all that much.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't watched his really good games lately, but, you know, has he given up an earned run his last three starts? I mean, it's pretty remarkable.
He's been excellent. I don't count on him, obviously, the way I do with Nolan Wheeler, but I get your point, and he was that good last year. And if he hasn't, listen, if he or Syndergaard
or Gibson
get it together, if one of those three get it together and you go into the playoffs with three good starters, you can get by with a mediocre fourth starter. What's your Eagles point?
The Eagles point, the guys that I'm interested in watching is the synergy between Jordan Davis and N'Kobe Dean. Now, I don't know how many years they played, how many seasons they played at Georgia, but they played together a lot. And they know each other. They know what each one's going to do. And I think that the sum of the two parts is greater than whatever, you know, that adage. I think they could be really, really good and surprisingly good.
I think it's a great point. Dean was the guy you wanted to see. Davis, the guy I want to see. You got the two best players from the best defense in the country who have played together, it will be something to see them when they click.
Yeah, I mean, the man I'm trying to replace here, Ray Dittinger, called that Georgia defense the best he had seen in college football in, 25 years or something like that. So, yeah, absolutely worth watching. To Mike's previous point, he was correct. Ranger Suarez has not allowed an earned run in any of his last three starts.
There you go. All right. Earlier this week, Angelo Cataldi and the morning team went to practice. They interviewed Nick Sirianni, and this conversation took place.
There's a story in the Inquirer today saying, ideally, you'd like to run it a little less and throw the ball a little more.
I don't know where they got that.
No, you don't?
I never told them that.
No, you didn't.
Because all right. My secrets are, yeah. I don't have, okay. I'm keeping everything in-house.
You're not
right?
saying anything.
I'm not saying it. Why would I say anything, right? Because then the teams that we're going to play are going to know something.
Okay, it's a bit of a non-denial denial, as they say.
Yes.
The story he's referring to is written by...
Do we know this clown?
You.
Yeah, oh.
Which was an excellent column, but they really kind of started off with the point that running backs are disposable and, you know, they aren't appreciated as they used to be and maybe they shouldn't be. And you kind of transition from that into the Eagles were great at running the ball last year. It worked, but clearly their moves in the offseason are designed to go another direction.
Yeah, I wasn't suggesting in the column that I had spoken to Nick Sirianni and that Nick had told me, we don't want to run the ball more. That was not the point of the column. That conversation never happened. What I was saying was that the Eagles' overriding philosophy, the way they think about offense, is that they want to throw the ball first and foremost. And that's basically been true since Jeffrey Lurie became the team's owner, and particularly since Howie Roseman has been in charge of player personnel and strategy and all that kind of stuff. And so the point of the column was, as well as the Eagles ran the ball last season, again, they don't really want to play that way. And if you look at where they've put their money in investing in players and their draft picks and those sorts of things, you can see that they want to throw the ball. You spend a first-round pick on Devontae Smith. You trade for A.J. Brown. You give Dallas Goedert a long contract extension. They want to throw the ball.
I have no disagreement with
yeah,
that.
And
I have no argument with that. And I think that they have the opportunity to have a balanced offense, which would be delightful.
It would be great. And it, again, comes down to the quarterback. You know, go back to those first seven games of last season. They didn't go into last season saying, you know, we have a great offensive line. We're just going to pound teams to death. They went into last season thinking, we're going to throw the ball. That's what we do. And we're going to see if Jalen Hurts can do it. And through seven games last season, they were 2-5, and Jalen Hurts was not a productive quarterback. And so they changed what they were doing out of necessity. It remains to be seen.
Why did it work so well?
The running game?
Yeah.
You have a tremendous offensive line.
That's exactly right.
You have a good variety of running backs in Boston Scott and Miles Sanders and last season Jordan Howard. And I think you'll see more of Kenny Gainwell this year, but again, it almost doesn't matter who the running backs are when the line is that good.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I agree with you. And I'm excited to see. I'm excited to see a balance. I'm very excited to see the team. I'm so excited. I'm flustered. Okay. I'm excited for a few things. I'm excited because
Somebody get Glenn a glass of ice water.
There you go. I think the defense is going to be that much better with the acquisitions they had, and we'll find out if Jonathan Gannon is a good coach this year. And my inclination is to think he is. And he's going to have guys that he can employ to do various schemes rather than the vanilla they did last year. I'm very excited for the offense because you do come back with the best line in football. We all agree on that. And barring injuries, that's going to stay that way. You have a nice platoon of running backs, depth guys, as you said, guys who bring different skills to it, all of whom are talented. Hey, I like Boston Scott, and I don't even know how much he's going to play, and I think he's very good. You have a top-flight tight end. And depth at that position. You have now a guy who comes in who's one of the A.J. Brown, one of the top 10 receivers in the league, fair to say?
I might even put him in the top five.
Okay, there you go. And he comes with a second-year guy who is explosive, can run patterns, has speed, and has good hands. And all of that together says this is going to work. Dot, dot, dot. However...
Hurts.
However, and that's what we don't know.
We don't know.
And I know it's discussed every day on every show, and I hate to just beat the dead horse, but it is. The whole thing rides on it.
And it's kind of scary if you're an Eagles fan, right? It's interesting if you cover the team and can take a step back from it and say, okay, I want to see what Jalen Hurts is. I want to see what he does off the field, in the intangible things on the field. He does everything right. And yet, we don't know what he's going to be once the spotlight comes on. And again, I've said this in the past, so much of this comes down to the modern NFL and A, the salary cap, because he's costing him less than $2 million under the cap this year, which is why they were able to make so many of these additions and improvements. And then the modern NFL is about throwing the ball, and the Eagles believe in that. And so at some point, if you're going to contend with the top teams in the NFC, the Rams, and presumably the 49ers, if, you know, Trey Lance becomes what they think he's going to be, and whoever else, the Packers, you have to be able to move the ball down the field, and your quarterback has to be able to make throws in important situations, and we have not seen that yet from Jalen Hurts.
Okay, so you've been to training camp a couple times. I'm reading... and hearing different reports from training camps, you know, the kids had a bad day, threw three interceptions, and I read Ruben Frank earlier this week, who's a guy whose opinion I really trust, and he said, hey, it looks actually pretty good. He's had more good days than bad days. Do you have an assessment based on what you've seen? Because I'm always really reluctant off of anything in camp, and even most things in preseason, to make too large adjustments, because that's when you're learning it. That's where you're getting it together. That's where they're trying different things.
I've been to camp two or three times. The frustrating part about covering the team and analyzing it through looking at Hurts is that we haven't seen anything one way or another that says he is different from what he was last season.
Mm-hmm.
Or that has reaffirmed what everybody already thinks of him. I'll give you an example of what I mean. I don't know if you saw this on social media yesterday, but there was a report out of Washington about an anecdote at Washington Commanders practice about Carson Wentz.
Yes.
Okay, during a drill, I don't know if it was 7-on-7 or whatever it was, Carson Wentz drops back, he's rolling out, and he's getting chased by a defensive lineman.
Montez Sweat. Yeah.
And while Sweat is chasing him, Sweat is saying to Wentz, throw it away, throw it away, throw it, and Wentz doesn't throw it away.
Runs out of bounds.
Yes. That is the sort of anecdote that is telling. That lets you know this is who Carson Wentz is. It reaffirms the reality of him as a quarterback. There hasn't been anything yet that I've seen where you look at Jalen Hurts and say, okay, now we know what kind of quarterback he is and is going to be. That just has not happened yet, to my eyes, in training camp, which is why there's this air of mystery around him heading into September 11th in
Detroit.
I
agree. I think we don't know. I think we don't know. And I appreciate Elliot. Please understand, I'm not knocking Elliot here because he tracks every pass every year, and I admire his diligence in doing it. But if Jalen Hurts is 8-for-15 with a touchdown and interception in a practice in July, I don't know what to make of that.
I'll say this, Glenn. There was, and again, you're right about focusing too much on one play in practice. There was one play at the most recent practice I was at, where Hurts rolled out in a drill and threw deep, and the pass was batted away. And it was one of those plays where you watch him and you go, yeah, he can run, but when it comes to throwing the football, it took a bit for him to get the ball down the field. Where you look at Wentz and the natural athletic gifts that Wentz has, it would have been an easier throw. I'm not suggesting that Carson Wentz is better or that, you know,
well,
he would have made a smart decision.
Nobody's going to argue
you
that.
You can see why talent people become infatuated with a guy like Wentz and why they question whether Hurts can do it.
Well, Wentz was the second pick of the draft.
Exactly.
Hurts.
It is 9:46 p.m. 2-2 to Harvey Keene. One strike away. Sandy into his windup. Here's the pitch. Swung on and missed. A perfect game.
Okay, that's an old clip, and I could have used any clip to set up Vin Scully and our little tribute here to him. But I chose one, and I know it is, oh gosh, it's more than 50 years old. It's Sandy Koufax's perfect game, 1965, I think, against the Cubs.
Right.
And the reason I did that is because I invite everybody today to go onto YouTube and just Google the ninth inning of that game, which is only about 6 minutes long because Sandy Koufax is going to get everybody out. And the way Vin Scully does that is so poetic, and he paints the picture. He doesn't overspeak. He sets the moment, sets the time, and he passed away this week, which is obviously why we're doing it. And Mike, I just want to give us each an opportunity to talk about him a little bit because I think that Vin Scully is the best there ever was.
I agree with you, and I would take it in a way kind of a step further. I can remember watching Game 1 of the 1988 World Series between the Dodgers and the Oakland Athletics. Now, 2 years earlier, the Mets win the World Series, and of course you have Scully calling the game for NBC on TV with Joe Garagiola and that iconic call of behind the bag, it gets by through Buckner, et cetera, et cetera.
By the way, you know where I watched that game? I watched that game from the Wyndham Franklin Plaza Hotel as I was interviewing to write for The Inquirer.
Is that right?
That's the weekend I came in to do my job interview with The Inquirer.
We both have interesting Inquirer interview stories.
Okay.
I was interviewing for my job at The Inquirer as Charlie Manuel was being fired by the Phillies.
Oh, the Wawa bag.
Yes.
Okay. Anyway, go ahead. So, Vin.
Yeah, game one of the 88 World Series. If you remember it, it is Kirk Gibson hitting the home run off of Dennis Eckersley in the bottom of the ninth inning. And to me, that is the most dramatic and memorable TV sports moment in history. I know some people will say the Miracle on Ice in 1980 and, you know, do you believe in miracles? But if you go back and watch that the entirety of that game, and in particular the ninth inning, the way Vin Scully shepherds the viewers through the possibility that Gibson is going to come up and he is injured, and the way he takes you through that at bat and the drama just builds and builds and builds. And then when Gibson hits the ball over the fence, he goes quiet for 66 seconds and lets you exist in that moment and then comes back with, in a year which has been so improbable, the impossible has happened.
Yeah.
And it is the perfect line to capture what was going on with that Dodgers team at that time. I agree with you. I think he's the best there ever was.
You know, the resume of everything he did is incredible to read. I mean, he called most of Jackie Robinson's
yes.
career, and then he called most of Clayton Kershaw's career. That's how long it spanned. He called the Hank Aaron, 715. You mentioned the Gibson thing, 25 World Series. He did football. He called the catch in 1981. He was, to me, more than anything, kind of the reminder, the steward of what baseball was at its peak. He's the guy who brought you back to simpler times in a certain way, if that makes any sense. He was a time machine, but he wasn't a guy who got stale.
No, and if you read the tributes to him coming out of Los Angeles and the people who knew him well, I think two things stand out, apart from just his excellence as a broadcaster. Number one, and I met him briefly in 2010 when I was covering baseball and was covering a series in Los Angeles. By all accounts, he was a prince of a man.
Yeah.
Just absolutely a terrific, terrific human being.
I met him for 30 seconds.
And then the other thing kind of tied to that is you hear the word and read the word friend being used a lot to describe the relationship between him and the viewers and the listeners. And of course, when you think of that dynamic locally, you think of Harry Callis and Richie Ashburn. You think of Tom McCarthy on TV now and Scott Fransky on the radio now. And that is a dynamic that is very difficult to capture and yet is so essential to broadcasting baseball.
When you, and I told everybody, go back and listen to that ninth inning of the Koufax no-hitter. And I'm telling you, it'll take you, you know, 6 minutes. But after that, listen to Fransky calling the last out of Halliday's game against the no-hitter in the playoffs against the Reds.
Mm-hmm.
And Fransky sets it up the same way and sets the moment perfectly. I think Fransky is terrific. The last thing I'll say about him, and it's kind of what we're saying, one of the things I liked about him is he was a wordsmith. He was a poet. He could contemporaneously speak, work by himself, and just tell you stories and keep you in the game. There were no hot takes. There were no stupid catchphrases. You know, there was no needless, well, he's by himself, but even with somebody else, there's no like, no, I'm on this side, you're on that side. There was none of that. He was just a genuine guy and a great broadcast.
There's a moment that you can find on YouTube of him calling a game between the Dodgers and the Giants, and Madison Bumgarner is pitching for the Giants. And Scully tells a story about Bumgarner that is so remarkable, you have to listen to it. I don't want to give it away.
Okay.
But what's even more remarkable is the way that he is able to weave in the action of the game so seamlessly as he is telling the story, and he ties a bow on it with a moral. It's really remarkable, and he's someone who it's fortunate we're going to be able to listen to him and that we have YouTube and these clips, you know, such as the one you played with him calling the Koufax perfect game, because a voice like Vin Scully's, a voice like Harry Callis's, they never die.
That's great. The best there ever was. Let's talk to, is it Anita or Anitra in Collegeville? Hello?
Yes, it's Anitra.
Hey, Anitra. Yeah, we got you. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Great.
Hi, Anitra.
So, just a couple of things. As far as I heard you guys talking about Jalen in practice, and what I think Eagles fans should love in every practice, every year, is that the quarterback doesn't look good all the time. And I know that may sound crazy, but if he looks good all the time, I mean, think about it. I would be extremely worried about our defense.
That's a good way to look at it.
So it really should be, in my eyes at least, 50-50. The offense should look great. The defense should look great. So those picks.
I hear you, but let me ask you a question. And I understand, neither Mike or I are among those who are panicking about this, but who is the single most important player on the Eagles this year, Anitra?
Obviously the quarterback.
Yeah, so
It's just that if he's getting picked off, I want to see a defensive player. I want to see a cornerback. I want to see someone, pick off his ball.
At least
once or twice, because if the offense looks totally polished, everything looks kosher.
Yeah, then you're worried about the defense. What do you have on Dick Vermeil?
As far as Dick Vermeil, didn't he the Eagles to the Super Bowl in 1980, right?
Correct.
So it's 2022. I was shocked when they said that he was inducted in the Hall of Fame, because I just knew he was already. Like, why did it take so long? Do you guys know that hear anybody.
We'll explain it to you.
Sure. Well, one of the things kind of working against him, Anitra, was that if you look at his overall coaching record, it's very good, but it's not spectacular. And there are reasons for that. He took over teams that were terrible when he got there, and by their third season, he made them terrific. In fact, that was kind of the big factual point that eventually got him into the Hall. You couldn't just look at his overall coaching record and say, this was an incredible coach. You had to dig a little deeper and understand how bad the Eagles were when he got there and how good he made them. Same thing with the St. Louis Rams or the Kansas City Chiefs. I think that goes a long way to explaining why it took Vermeil so long to get there.
And not a lot of coaches get in.
Right.
It's tough for coaches to get in. It's the I think the voters have gotten more conscious of it in recent years and kind of separated it out and do it better, but it's difficult for coaches. Again, you did a terrific piece on Vermeil this week. It was on the front page of the Inquirer. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I should tell people they should go and read it. And we'll talk about Dick when we talk to Dan Baker. We'll talk a little bit more about Dick. Robert, Washington Township, you're on with Mike Sielski and Glenn Mack now.
Good morning, guys. How you doing? Hey, Weezy, it's me, Bad Love, your favorite poster.
Hi, Robert. How are you?
I'm good, sir. Hey, listen, I wanted to talk about real quick Philly, but I had another thing to add on to that. Because, Mike, the thing you when you were talking about that Gibson home run, I was in California then, and I remember that. And I want to tell you, it was like a backstory to that in a little bit, where when he first got out there, they had a lefty reliever that had been around forever, and they put black inside his cap, like in the first, like preseason or spring training, whatever. Mm-hmm. And when Gibson came off and took his cap off and saw that,
yes,
he was furious.
Yes.
And he was like, this isn't what I signed up for. I'm not here to play around and have play games and stuff. I'm here to win a World Series. I think he set the tone early.
Yeah, you know, that season, Gibson was actually the National League MVP that year, and it wasn't because he had the greatest offensive season of anybody in the league. It was because of what he did intangibly and tangibly to take the Dodgers from kind of a group of also-rans to a team that won the World Series.
I don't remember too many of the guys. I remember Mickey Hatcher. He had a really good World Series. And
you would look at that roster and be stunned at that team winning a championship, other than Gibson and Oral Hershiser, who was incredible that year.
I was going to say they had some degree of a pitching staff, right?
Yeah, Tim Belcher was like their number two starter, I think.
I knew Gibson because I moved here from Detroit, so I knew him when I wrote for the Detroit Free Press, and he was a young player in Detroit. I mean, I was there during the 84 World Series. He hits the dramatic home run off of Goose Gossage. But he was intense.
Oh, yeah.
And he was, you know, he could be, you know who he was? Remember Dave Hollins here?
Oh, sure.
He was that kind of player. But that team, he was the young guy. So they had the Al Hollins and the Lou Whitakers and the Jack Morrises and the Dan Petries and the Chet Lemons and the veteran players. And so he could kind of be intense without rocking the boat too much. I think by the time he got to L.A., he still had the intensity, but he was more mature. He's more of a leader.
Yeah, and kind of, I don't want to say humorless, but bringing a sense of urgency, let's put it that way.
Yeah, he wasn't there to screw around.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. 215-592-9494. If you're on hold, stick around. We will get you in the next segment. We invite others to join. But we're going to have the pleasure of talking to Dan Baker, honored last night for 50 years. 50 years, Mike.
Remarkable.
I saw those pictures of him at the beginning with the, like, 1970s, you know, sport jackets on, big wide ties. And
what do I have to do to put you in this vehicle?
Yeah. Anyway, we're going to talk to him coming up. Mike and Glenn on that.
Ready to level up? Chumba Casino is your playbook to fun. It's free to play with no purchase necessary. Enjoy hundreds of online social games like blackjack, slots, and solitaire anytime, anywhere with fresh releases every week. Whether you're at home or on the go, let Chumba Casino bring the excitement to you. Plus, get free daily login bonuses and a free welcome bonus. Join now for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Play Chumba Casino today. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. T&Cs apply.
The Second World War is the largest event in human history.
A 20-part series with Tom Hanks.
No part of the globe was untouched. No life unchanged.
Experience the ultimate account of World War II.
Every single person had a story. These are the stories that make us who we are.
Listen to World War II with Tom Hanks on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It is 9:46 p.m. 2-2 to Harvey Keene. One strike away. Sandy into his windup. Here's the pitch. Swung on and missed. A perfect game.
Okay, that's an old clip, and I could have used any clip to set up Vin Scully and our little tribute here to him, but I chose one. And I know it is, oh gosh, it's more than 50 years old. It's Sandy Koufax's perfect game, 1965, I think, against the Cubs.
Right.
And the reason I did that is because I invite everybody today to go onto YouTube and just Google the ninth inning of that game, which is only about 6 minutes long because Sandy Koufax is going to get everybody out. And the way Vin Scully does that is so poetic, and he paints the picture. He doesn't overspeak. He sets the moment, sets the time. And he passed away this week, which is obviously where we're doing it. And Mike, I just want to give us each an opportunity to talk about him a little bit, because I think that Vin Scully is the best there ever was.
I agree with you. And I would take it, in a way, kind of a step further. I can remember watching Game 1 of the 1988 World Series between the Dodgers and the Oakland Athletics. Now, 2 years earlier, the Mets win the World Series, and of course you have Scully calling the game for NBC on TV with Joe Garagiola, and that iconic call of behind the bag, it gets by through Buckner, et cetera, et cetera.
By the way, you know where I watched that game? I watched that game from the Wyndham Franklin Plaza Hotel as I was interviewing to write for the Inquirer.
Is that right?
That's the weekend I came in to do my job interview with the Inquirer.
We both have interesting Inquirer interview stories. Okay. I was interviewing for my job at the Inquirer as Charlie Manuel was being fired by the Phillies.
Oh, the Wawa bag.
Yes.
Okay. Anyway, go ahead. So, Vin.
Yeah, game one of the 88 World Series. If you remember it, it is Kirk Gibson hitting the home run off of Dennis Eckersley in the bottom of the ninth inning. And to me, that is the most dramatic and memorable TV sports moment in history. I know some people will say the Miracle on Ice in 1980 and, you know, do you believe in miracles? But if you go back and watch that, the entirety of that game, and in particular the ninth inning, the way Vin Scully shepherds the viewers through the possibility that Gibson is going to come up and he is injured, and the way he takes you through that at bat, and the drama just builds and builds and builds. And then when Gibson hits the ball over the fence, he goes quiet for 66 seconds and lets you exist in that moment, and then comes back with, in a year which has been so improbable, the impossible has happened.
Yeah.
And it is the perfect line to capture what was going on with that Dodgers team at that time. I agree with you. I think he's the best there ever was.
You know, the resume of everything he did is incredible to read. I mean, he called most of Jackie Robinson's career, and then he called most of Clayton Kershaw's career. That's how long it spanned. He called the Hank Aaron 715. You mentioned the Gibson thing, 25 World Series. He did football. He called the catch in 1981. He was, to me, more than anything, kind of the reminder, the steward of what baseball was at its peak. He's the guy who brought you back to simpler times in a certain way, if that makes any sense. He was a time machine, but he wasn't a guy who got stale.
No, and if you read the tributes to him coming out of Los Angeles and the people who knew him well, I think two things stand out, apart from just his excellence as a broadcaster. Number one, and I met him briefly in 2010 when I was covering baseball and was covering a series in Los Angeles. By all accounts, he was a prince of a man.
Yeah.
Just absolutely a terrific, terrific human being.
I met him for 30 seconds.
And then the other thing kind of tied to that is you hear the word and read the word friend being used a lot to describe the relationship between him and the viewers and the listeners. And of course, when you think of that dynamic locally, you think of Harry Callis and Richie Ashburn. You think of Tom McCarthy on TV now and Scott Fransky on the radio now. And that is a dynamic that is very difficult to capture and yet is so essential to broadcasting baseball.
When you, and I told everybody, go back and listen to that ninth inning of the Koufax no-hitter. And I'm telling you, it'll take you, you know, 6 minutes. But after that, listen to Fransky calling the last out of Halliday's game against the no-hitter in the playoffs against the Reds. And Fransky sets it up the same way and sets the moment perfectly. I think Fransky is terrific. The last thing I'll say about him, and it's kind of what we're saying, one of the things I liked about him is he was a wordsmith. He was a poet. He could contemporaneously speak, work by himself, and just tell you stories and keep you in the game. There were no hot takes. There were no stupid catchphrases, you know. There was no needless, well, he's by himself, but even with somebody else, there's no like, no, I'm on this side, you're on that side. There was none of that. He was just a genuine guy and a great broadcast.
There's a moment that you can find on YouTube of him calling a game between the Dodgers and the Giants, and Madison Bumgarner is pitching for the Giants. And Scully tells a story about Bumgarner that is so remarkable, you have to listen to it. I don't want to give it away.
Okay.
But what's even more remarkable is the way that he is able to weave in the action of the game so seamlessly as he is telling the story, and he ties a bow on it with a moral. It's really remarkable, and he's someone who it's fortunate we're going to be able to listen to him and that we have YouTube and these clips, you know, such as the one you played with him calling the Koufax perfect game, because a voice like Vin Scully's, a voice like Harry Callis's, they never die.
That's great. The best there ever was. Let's talk to, is it Anita or Anitra in Collegeville? Hello?
Yes, it's Anitra.
Hey, Anitra. Yeah, we got you. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Great.
Hi, Anitra.
So, hi. So, just a couple of things. As far as I heard you guys talking about Jalen in practice, mm-hmm. and what I think Eagles fans should love in every practice, every year, is that the quarterback doesn't look good all the time. And I know that may sound crazy, but if he looks good all the time, I mean, think about it. I would be extremely worried about our defense.
That's a good way to look at it.
So it really should be, in my eyes at least, 50-50. The offense should look great. The defense should look great. So those picks.
I hear you, but let me ask you a question. Uh-huh. And I understand, neither Mike or I are among those who are panicking about this, but... Who is the single most important player on the Eagles this year, Anitra?
Obviously, the quarterback.
Yeah, so
it's just that if he's getting picked off, I want to see a defensive player. I want to see a cornerback. I want to see someone, pick off his ball.
Yeah, at least
once or twice. Because if the offense looks totally polished. Everything looks kosher.
Yeah, then you're worried about the defense. What do you have on?
I am extremely worried.
What do you have on Dick Vermeil?
As far as Dick Vermeil, didn't he the Eagles to the Super Bowl in 1980, right?
Correct.
So it's 2022. I was shocked when they said that he was inducted in the Hall of Fame because I just knew he was already. Like, why did it take so long? Do you guys know that
I didn't hear
anybody.
No, we'll explain it to you.
Sure. Well, one of the things kind of working against him, Anitra, was that if you look at his overall coaching record, it's very good, but it's not spectacular. And there are reasons for that. He took over teams that were terrible when he got there, and by their third season, he made them terrific. In fact, that was kind of the big factual point that eventually got him into the hall. You couldn't just look at his overall coaching record and say, this was an incredible coach. You had to dig a little deeper and understand how bad the Eagles were when he got there and how good he made them. Same thing with the St. Louis Rams or the Kansas City Chiefs. I think that goes a long way to explaining why it took Vermeil so long to get there.
And not a lot of coaches get in.
Right.
It's tough for coaches to get in. I think the voters have gotten more conscious of it in recent years and kind of separated it out and do it better, but it's difficult for coaches. Again, you did a terrific piece on Vermeil this week. It was on the front page of the Inquirer. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I should tell people they should go and read it. And we'll talk about Dick when we talk to Dan Baker. We'll talk a little bit more about Dick. Robert, Washington Township, you're on with Mike Sielski and Glenn Mack now.
Good morning, guys. How you doing? Hey, Weezy, it's me, Bad Love, your favorite poster.
Hi, Robert. How are you?
I'm good, sir. Hey, listen, I wanted to talk about real quick Philly, but I had another thing to add on to that because, Mike, the thing you when you were talking about that Gibson home run, I was in California then, and I remember that. And I want to tell you, it was like a backstory to that in a little bit, where when he first got out there, they had a lefty reliever that had been around forever, and they put black inside his cap, like in the first, like preseason or spring training, whatever. Mm-hmm. And when Gibson came off and took his cap off and saw that,
yes.
He was furious.
Yes.
And he was like, this isn't what I signed up for. I'm not here to play around and play games and stuff. I'm here to win a World Series. I think he set the tone early.
Yeah, that season, Gibson was actually the National League MVP that year, and it wasn't because he had the greatest offensive season of anybody in the league. It was because of what he did intangibly and tangibly to take the Dodgers from kind of a group of also-rans to a team that won the World Series.
You probably don't remember too many of the guys. I remember Mickey Hatcher. He had a really good World Series. And
you would look at that roster and be stunned at that team winning a championship, other than Gibson and Oral Hershiser, who was incredible that year.
I was going to say they had some degree of a pitching staff, right?
Yeah, Tim Belcher was like their number two starter, I think.
I knew Gibson because I moved here from Detroit, so I knew him when I wrote for the Detroit Free Press, and he was a young player in Detroit. I mean, I was there during the 84 World Series. He hits the dramatic home run off of Goose Gossage. But he was intense.
Oh, yeah.
And he was, you know, he could be, you know who he was? Remember Dave Hollins here?
Oh, sure.
He was that kind of player. But that team, he was the young guy. So they had the Al Hollins and the Lou Whitakers and the Jack Morrises and the Dan Petries and the Chet Lemons and the veteran players. And so he could kind of be intense without rocking the boat too much. I think by the time he got to L.A., he still had the intensity, but he was more mature. He's more of a leader.
Yeah, and kind of, I don't want to say humorless, but bringing a sense of urgency, let's put it that way.
Yeah, he wasn't there to screw around.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. 215-592-9494. If you're on hold, stick around. We will get you in the next segment. We invite others to join. But we're going to have the pleasure of talking to Dan Baker, honored last night for 50 years. 50 years, Mike.
Remarkable.
I saw those pictures of him at the beginning with the, like, 1970s, you know, sport jackets on, big wide ties. And
what do I have to do to put you in this vehicle?
Yeah. Anyway, we're going to talk to him coming up. Mike and Glenn on that.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing.
And Bubba Wallace.
You know what's the worst part of a race? A rain delay.
Sitting around waiting for the track to dry is dull.
But instead of waiting, we hang out with Chumba Casino.
Social casino slots, bingo, solitaire, plenty of fun to keep us entertained.
So why let a rain delay slow you down? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, this is Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst, certified financial planner, and the host of the Jill on Money podcast. Beginning, middle, or end of the year, it's always a great time to take control of your financial life. And the Jill on Money podcast is here to help. Your questions make it possible for me to provide unconventional and entertaining insights on your money and, more importantly, on your life. Follow and listen to Jill on Money wherever you get your podcasts.